Right, welcome everyone to this latest edition of the Positive Populist podcast. My guest today is Ryan Williams. He is president of the Claremont Institute and publisher of the Claremont Review of Books. First question, Ryan, are you a positive populist?
Sure, Steve, with one caveat, I guess. I always like to tell people populism in America is an easier thing to subscribe to than elsewhere, because I think that populism in America has always been rooted in the American theory of government, which is that the sovereignty of the people rule. Uh-huh. But the sovereignty of the people in America have always ruled within a framework of the protection for minority rights. So populism is safeguarded by the Declaration and the Constitution.
So when it's interesting, because you immediately went to, I think, the core idea, yeah. Certainly the one that I believe in, what seems to come out in all of these conversations, mm-hmm. which is that notion of power, you know, sort of more political language, power to the people right. power, something around that.
Right.
But what I was really interested in the answer was your historical reference. Yeah. You know, you said, I think you said, has always been.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear you talk about that a bit more.
Sure.
In terms of, because a lot of people think, oh, this is a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
Populism, this, it came in with Trump.
Yeah.
And I guess Bernie Sanders on the left.
Right.
Although we've had an interesting conversation about, I think it was with Tammy Bruce, who was really clear about, you can't be a populist on the left because the left believe in taking power away from people.
Uh-huh.
So it's literally impossible. Anyway, that's a digression. Yeah. I'd love your take then about what's behind that when you say it's always been the historical tradition.
Well, people get worried about the term populism in American politics because they trace it back to the late 19th century and mm-hmm. the turn of the century and the Populist Party. And the famous line from William Jennings Bryan was, whatever the people are for, I'm for. And this makes,
right.
this makes small R Republicans nervous, because the people could be for bad things and not just good things. So what I mean by populism in America being having a deep strain, it's just that we're a popular government. We always were a government based on the authority of the people and the sovereignty of the people, translating that sovereignty through the institutions so that they could govern in a small R Republican fashion. So populism, I think at its worst or at its most malleable, would just be whatever the people are for, I'm
so
for.
Basically some sort of giant version of an opinion poll.
Right.
Where you say, right, this is what people want.
I know that's not what you mean by it. It's not
no,
what I mean
but
by
I,
it. Yeah.
And another phrase that you hear a lot associated with that type of populism is rule of the mob.
Right.
You hear that a lot, don't
mm-hmm.
you? But let's go back to the historical thing. So, maybe some people know this, maybe others don't. So I'd love to make sure that we cover everyone.
Sure.
The Populist Party. Uh-huh. What was the story there? What was that about?
Well, it grew out of the farming community that was.
So what year are we talking?
So we're talking the first populist, or really the Grange Party, was this popular party based in farmers who were upset with banks.
The
Grange Party, the lack of credit, and that evolved into a People's Party.
So just I'm being yeah. very ignorant,
sure,
now, but
no,
the Grange, did that refer to something? It wasn't someone's name, or
no,
was
no.
it? No, it referred specifically to the agricultural.
Yeah, I forget the exact etymology of the Grange movement, but it was very much a farmers based movement.
Uh-huh.
Fed up with the banking system of the East and the lack of credit for
so
farmers.
What year was this?
So it quickly morphed into the People's Party, which I think the first People's Conference was maybe in 1880. It's been
okay.
a while since I've read
All right.
through the history.
It's around Lincoln's time.
20 years after. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So 80, you said
yeah,
80,
80,
not 60.
Yeah,
exactly.
Not 60.
So after
yeah.
the, right, got it.
Really the start of the Gilded Age, as it was called later.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So this period between sort of the progressivism going really national, which would be in 1912 probably, and after the Civil War. So between the Civil War and the ascent of progressivism.
So that's the first time we see
a real People's Party, yeah.
Right.
And or a populist party.
So how did they relate? So the Grange, and then the People's Party was established as a party.
Mm-hmm.
And who was there? Is that William Jennings Bryan?
He ran under the populist ticket, yeah, and then.
But
later,
that time it was called the
later
People's
the,
Party,
right?
Not the populist, or was it
the people? Well, the Populist Party, yeah.
Right.
Right.
And how did they see themselves in relation to the other bits of the political map at the time?
They were a little uncategorizable. I mean, they would later morph into the Progressive Party.
Uh-huh.
And which would then be absorbed by the Democratic Party. But they wanted easier credit for small farmers. They wanted postal savings banks, which was a progressive reform, policy reform taken up both by the progressive Republicans, so-called Teddy Roosevelt and then William Howard Taft, but also the populace. So there was this bipartisan sense that the old elite establishment was not serving all the people properly.
So, so there was actually really pretty similar to to the kind of feeling today, where you've got the coastal, the sense that the coastal elites are not listening to and not representing those who live in the heartland, who live in who work in industries that may not be the ones that those in the coasts work in. I mean, today we see that divide in terms of what's described as the knowledge economy versus manufacturing. Back in the day, that was kind of agriculture versus finance. Was that the kind of distinction?
The Eastern bankers, and then out west, there was also the sort of mining community. So flyover country back then, if we can put it that way, were the sort of the mining west and the agricultural south, and then and the middle of the country as well.
Interesting.
So the big disjunction being the commercial folks who brought livestock and stuff to market versus the people actually supplying the livestock, growing it, or doing the mining and bringing the ore to market. And then the other class were the financiers and the middlemen.
And so it's interesting, the left-right thing. So that went in the direction, I mean, what would just, in your opinion, did that end up, that movement, going too far in a leftward centralizing big government direction?
Maybe they did. I mean, part of that, they did call for the nationalization of the railroads. That was part of so I would say that's probably a bridge too far. They also had this tendency that all small D democratic movements have, which is to devalue money to make creditors, to make it a more favorable climate for debtors. Rather than creditors. So if you have a lot of farmers who are deeply in debt for various reasons, it's always tempting to transfer wealth surreptitiously from the people who hold that debt to the debtors by devaluing the currency. So there was an aspect of that as well.
Okay. So then let's just come up to date. So how do you see what's been going on since the term became popularized in the last few years?
Yeah, I think two ways to think about it, at least. My colleague Angelo Codevilla has talked about it as the ruling class versus the country class, with an old UK flavor in certain sense. And then my colleague Charles Kessler has talked about it in terms of two constitutions. So the populists, whether it be the Tea Party or the Trumpian evolution of that, we're kind of want to return to the old constitution, the constitution of individual rights, and a large thriving middle class. Whereas the new constitution or the living constitution has a new view of rights, and the modern progressives and liberals in the Democratic Party have embraced that. So it's the notion that not individual rights held by individuals, but rather group rights or evolving rights or and the biggest distinction I think relevant to our listeners or your listeners, the new living constitution really means government needs to be unlimited because rights are ever changing. And the only way to make us all prosperous is to give government, and especially scientific management and government, the opportunity to endlessly create new rights and distribute new resources.
I there's so much interesting there to unpack. One phrase that really leapt out was that notion of the scientific management.
Yeah.
That reminds me of something I found really interesting when looking at the history of the concentration of economic power and the way that big corporations have been allowed to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and in many cases squeeze out upstarts and smaller companies and those seeking to challenge them. And when you look into that philosophy of allowing and encouraging that, actually, which has sort of taken over the legal aspect and the kind of the doctrine of consumer welfare in competition, antitrust policy, which means that, well, as long as prices are low, it doesn't matter if these companies are getting bigger and bigger. One of the originators of all of that was actually J.K. Galbraith, the left-wing economist who made that exact argument about, well, these benevolent big corporations through management theory will end up producing the best result. And so we should be encouraged that because it means that you'll end up with better outcomes if you've got these centralized repositories of knowledge.
Right.
It goes directly opposite to the kind of decentralizing, I guess this would be, you know, you'd go in a more libertarian direction, the Hayekian, you know, the minute you centralize power too much, You're on the Road to Serfdom, yeah. Hayek's book.
Right, and he talks more about governmental power. But I think we have a review in the magazine coming up which investigates this Hayekian question, but they say one of his blind spots was he didn't apply this to corporate power.
Interesting. Yeah, so okay,
government. So I think you're exactly right.
That's so interesting, that interplay. All right, so let's go to the question of how this relates to conservatism. I've always been so interested in that tension. How do you see that?
I think it's a good question. And it actually involves a split in the Republican Party at the turn of the 20th century. So both Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft were big into using antitrust to break up large corporations. Taft's focus was, no, look, we use the law. And we use it to promote competition. So anti-competitive practices we have to go after. Teddy Roosevelt had much more of a, I don't want to call it populist, but much more of a Rooseveltian solution, which is, no, we just need to pick a couple of the big ones, make an example out of them,
right,
and we can find some arrangement with the others.
Oh, interesting.
So one was a kind of rule of law focus, the other was much more of a PR operation.
That's such an interesting take on that. I've never heard that before.
Yeah. As far as modern conservatism goes,
because I've always taken that superficial, oh, Teddy Roosevelt, great. He was
trust-busting Teddy.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, his successor actually.
So you're saying it's less sort of intellectually coherent or based, rooted in principle.
Yeah, and Taft, who was a lawyer by heart, wanted to go after it much more methodically and actually prosecuted more antitrust cases, but did it more boring.
What about Brandeis? So he comes up a lot of especially the people on those on the left right now who are arguing the kind of pro. Tougher antitrust policy. I agree with that impulse. They go back to Brandeis and they say he's really the kind of intellectual father of a lot of this.
Yeah, well, he was more on the judicial side, which Taft would be later. But yeah, I mean, he's certainly in play. Yeah,
but do you look approvingly on that kind of Brandeisian?
No, I think
there's a lot of people. Oh no, he's on the left. That's no good.
Yeah, no, I think Brandeis has many jurisprudential problems other than just antitrust.
Right.
I think he fundamentally viewed the Constitution as something other than what the founders intended. So I part ways with him. As for modern conservatism, I think one of the big blind spots, and this has to do with the kind of libertarianization of the right over the last 30 years, has been just a dogmatic attachment to no, antitrust. You can't do that. It's all about economies of scale. It's all about lowering prices.
Yeah.
Microsoft being huge, Google being huge, that's fine. They're providing wonderful services.
People
want it. We don't have to worry about the corporate power problem. And I think a little more nuance on that question is needed. I think Trump understood that instinctually. Mm-hmm. Some people around him do. I think we're just starting to figure out what that might mean, especially with regards to our big, big tech platforms and their ability to censor speech and editorial and exercise real editorial control.
Yes.
While claiming to be neutral platforms.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I always want to make the point that it's not just in tech.
Sure.
It's easiest, I think, for conservatives to go after the tech concentration of power and monopoly there because of this political role, or the speech role. But actually, when you look at the pharmaceutical industry or insurance or whatever, all these other sectors of the economy are also much more concentrated. And there it may not be so immediately evident how damaging that is because they're not literally affecting the information and our conversation and so on, the culture. But they hurt. There's an impact on employees, for example.
Sure.
If you've got workers who have less choice of workplace because industries are becoming so concentrated, their power relative to the worker is greater.
Yeah, and I think it dovetails nicely with the rise of populism and Trumpism and even Bernieism or Sandersism.
Right.
Because since mid-century in America, as you've had a large federal establishment grow, a large bureaucracy grow, there's been a nice symbiotic relationship between big business who can afford the regulatory costs and capture and help guide policy that then affects them.
Yes.
So it's really this weird, unholy alliance between the bureaucracy, the lawyers in Washington, and the largest firms carving out their pieces and their success. When, the middle class and the small business owner suffers.
So the thing I'm interested in there is that this whole language and this way of thinking feels very natural. To just listening to you speak, it feels like you don't sound like someone who's, I don't know, let me just use cliches here, kind of establishment Republican who's kind of trying to come to terms with all of this. It feels like this is rooted in something deep with you. And I just wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about Claremont.
Sure.
And your relationship to Claremont, how Claremont got going. I think mm-hmm. that'll be fascinating to hear about.
Yeah, so the Claremont Institute will be 40 this year. Mm-hmm. Was founded by some graduate students at the Claremont Graduate University who were all really students of Harry Jaffa in one way or another, a great Lincoln scholar now dead. But they decided they didn't really want to go into academia. They weren't averse to academia, but they thought in the waning years of the Carter administration, they hoped the waning years,
right.
As he was fighting for re-election against Reagan, they thought, you know, let's go out and try to convince our fellow citizens and our fellow conservatives about what they should be for. We're pretty sure they all know what they're against abroad, which is communism, the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. What they're generally against at home is communism at home and unlimited government, but they really don't know the outlines of what they should be for. Mm-hmm. So they thought that the conservative movement's touchstone should be the principles of the American founding and their completion in a way by Abraham Lincoln's talk of the Declaration of Independence. So that was our mission. Our mission is to restore those principles to their rightful and preeminent place in national life. And what we do that is we teach.
But move on from the founding there, why did they feel that was necessary? I mean, at that time, so we're talking about late 70s.
79, yeah.
Did you have, well, maybe you didn't, maybe, I don't know the history of the other, did you have, I don't know, these kind of famous bastions of this country? Do you have the AEI or the Heritage Foundation or Cato, more libertarian? But did you have organizations on the right that were on a similar sort of page? Why did they feel that they needed to this argument?
Well, AEI had been around for a long time. I think it was founded in the 40s. But it was kind of a bipartisan policy shop.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so in some ways, they leaned libertarian. But and then the Heritage Foundation, I think, was founded in 1977. So it was very new as well. Uh-huh. And we've done partnerships with Heritage over the years. But we thought that our niche...
And just to be clear, they were... is it as simple as they were East Coast and Claremont was West Coast?
In a way,
California based.
In a way, I mean, Heritage, Ed Fulner and Paul Weyrich founded it, but they were frustrated when they went to somebody. They were staffers, and they saw this great AEI report, and they said, "Why didn't you give that to us? It could have helped us sway votes on the Hill." And the AEI scholar's response, maybe it was even the president at the time, said, "Oh, we would never want to influence legislation."
Right.
So they thought this is a market we need to address. So they wanted to be policy advocates. Well, what we always thought was ideas were upstream from policy in a way, mm-hmm. more important. Mm-hmm. So to get those fundamentals right required a focus. And so our focus had always been the principles. I mean, we never shy away from talking generally about policy, mm-hmm. but our day-to-day work has never been applied policy.
So do you use the word conservative to describe Claremont?
I mean, we certainly grew up in the conservative intellectual movement that, was kind of launched in a way at mid-century and gained a lot of steam up through the Reagan years. We were born right before the Reagan years, so to speak. But I think, you know, conservative has always been a confusing term to people. And the conservative movement has always been confused what conservatism in the United States should be about. Mm-hmm. So what we thought was the salvation of the West depends on America, and the West is definitely in crisis. The mm-hmm. salvation of America depends on the American right. The American right, in a way, depends on the Republican Party, and the Republican Party to do good things has to properly understand what conservatism is.
Right.
And our point was conservatism is not Hayekian gradualism. It's not traditionalism from Burke. It's this distinctively American thing.
Yeah.
Which in a way is conservative, but at the same time, small L liberal and revolutionary in a way, because the Declaration of Independence was not a small C conservative document. I mean, it was a claim to universal rights uh-huh. and the overthrow of a government, which is kind of a radical thing to do.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, when Trump appears on the scene, mm-hmm. and certainly this was my observation, just looking at the Claremont Review of Books, and so mm-hmm. you know, it just felt like you and your organization was kind of Trump friendly, I mm-hmm. guess. I'm sure you wouldn't. Well, maybe I'll ask you, Ron. But sure. Call yourselves a Trump supporting organization, but you certainly felt open in a way that these other places didn't.
Yeah, I think, you know, it partly had to do, we're all the way out here in California, so we're by geography a little less prone to the groupthink of the mm-hmm. Beltway. Mm-hmm. That helps. We've always made a conscious decision to stay out here, but I think also the way that Trump was seem to be pulling together a real popular electoral coalition that was aimed for the rule of law and against the sort of soulless bureaucratic administrative state and for middle America and for secure borders and for in a way economic policy and a trade policy that looked after the middle class and a return to sanity in foreign policy, which had been slightly overtaken by millenarian or utopian goals, whether it be a Wilsonian left or the neoconservative right.
Right.
Those, I mean, we've been arguing against, we had no huge problem with the initial decision to go into Iraq, but as soon as it changed into a democracy project, we'd been writing against it in the magazine since basically the beginning. So we had been a little heterodox on foreign policy. So that was an easy one for us. And we'd always been against the large administrative state. That was easy for us. On trade, we didn't really have very many settled views. I mean, we were Reagan free traders, I suppose, but perfectly willing to understand the need to recognize that policies are not principles and policies need to change sometimes.
Right.
And there's nothing.
So not dogmatic.
Right. And and you know, as Charles Kessler wrote a couple years ago, you know, Trump in a way is returning the Republican Party to its roots. You know, in the 1880s, the Republican Party was sort of pro-assimilationist on immigration, kind of closed borders, pro-tariff to look after American workers, and slightly more modest in its
policy. Is there a particular essay that people should, or piece that people should look at from Charles that...
Yeah, it's called The Republican Trump.
Interesting.
Written, I think, in the spring.
Just quickly mention the website where people...
Yeah, people can find all this stuff at www.claremont.org. And /CRB is the magazine's subsection, but claremont.org is...
So The Republican Trump was... When was that?
I think he published it in the spring of 2017.
Right.
Yeah.
And what were some of the other pieces that I think... Just talk about some of the other ways you've responded to this.
Right, sure. I wrote on Trump's first inaugural for Fox News, Charles Kessler and William Vogley both have written for the magazine quite a bit on Trump. Bill's launching piece was called Why I'm Anti-Trump, and that was in spring of 16. Uh-huh. But the biggest one that made the biggest impact was Michael Anton's, published pseudonymously at the time, the Flight 93 election, which was a more polemical, clarion call for Trump's not that bad. In fact, he might be the best option. And let's get over ourselves and see if we can't make America
great. I remember that. When was that?
That was published right after Labor Day in 2016.
Right.
And then Rush Limbaugh read it on the air, crashed our website, and the rest is history.
Very good. And what was it? I mean, you're the president.
Yeah.
And was it on you? Did you get that? But did you commission that? How did it work?
My predecessor, Michael Pack, was president at the time. I took over the September 17.
Right.
But I was there as COO and had been there for many years. Mike, as he reminds everyone, had written a piece a few months prior that we had rejected. We thought it was a little too hot. And he ended up publishing it somewhere else. But then he and some friends started this blog called the Journal of American Greatness.
Right.
And that lasted for 4 months into this early summer. And then we saw him at the American Political Science Association. And he basically spent 4 days just writing this thing, submitted it to us.
Right.
We did a quick edit and decided it was the right time and the right piece.
Yeah.
But really the Mike wrote it and was really the energy behind it, and Charles Kessler signed off on it.
Right.
So I'm glad both of them did both those things. Yeah.
And then tell us about your sort of entry into this world. How have you got to this point?
I went to Hillsdale College right when Larry Arnn started as president.
It's assumed a kind of mythic proportion in my mind, because I remember reading a most brilliant, very short piece, actually. Well, no, it's an extract. That's right, in the Wall Street Journal, from a speech he'd given or, written a piece or something. That's the first time I came across Larry Arnn.
Yeah.
I think he's so interesting.
Well, he's one of the founders of the Claremont Institute and ran the Institute from 1985 to 2000, then went to Hillsdale and took it over, and that's when I went to Hillsdale.
Uh-huh.
So that was my first real exposure to the magazine, to the Institute, because it was laying around the political science offices at Hillsdale. And then I did one of our summer fellowship programs, our being the Claremont Institute, right after I graduated.
Right.
And then came out for graduate school a year later and started working part-time while in graduate school.
Wow.
And a few years later was running our fellowship programs. A few years
so
after,
so you've been
that.
There for, you know, you've worked your way
since
up.
Since 2005.
Been...
Yeah.
Ah, very cool.
Yeah,
it's such an interesting. I mean, I just think people. It's really heartening to see how many, kind of really committed and intellectually robust kind of outlets there are for this kind of thinking and this kind of constitutional thinking, and how it's, but it's just such a mile away from how the establishment think of the whole kind of phenomenon of Donald Trump and his movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they get a little distracted by his unorthodox basket of policy thing. You know, the Reagan policy basket came on a, took on a kind of mythic status.
Yeah.
And Trump, Trump's blasé puncturing of it, and I don't mean really of Reagan or Reaganism, just that basket of policies,
yes,
is offending to many people who've made their living off of it for many years and talked a lot about it and invested in it for many years. And his, he's aesthetically off-putting for various reasons.
That's right. That's a huge part of
and
it.
So that's a big hurdle for some people.
Yeah.
And, you know, the we'd convinced ourselves that genteel politics is kind of the way it's always been done, whereas if you, anyone acquainted with the history of small d democratic politics in America, know that it's been anything than genteel often. So we're, our historical perspective on that front makes us a little less prone to hyperventilation about Trump.
I think that's right, and I think that that, you know, it's all style over substance. It's oh, I can't even believe the way he looks and, you know, the way he speaks. Oh, you know, it's not like we were used to after all our time in the establishment. It's just, but those are the very things that people love about him.
Yeah.
That those who support him.
Yeah.
It's literally those things that, that make it clear that he's on their side fighting for them rather than being captured by the enemy.
Yeah. And then even, you know, we have a interview with Norman Podhoretz coming up in the next issue that Charles Kessler did. And I think a lot of people are like Norman. I am to a certain extent. You know, we were tepid Trump supporters when in the beginning when we started to see this as a very interesting phenomenon. But as his enemies have gone completely insane, we grow more and more attached to him in a way, because he has all the right enemies, or many of the right enemies. And the repeated obsessive kind of hysteria over him just, you know, makes some of us grow a little more passionately attached to what he does to the, these people, which can be quite amusing.
And so looking forward, where do you see that going? I mean, I'd love you just to sort of look ahead, I guess, to a second Trump term, if that happens, what your hopes would be there. But more than that, you know, beyond Trump, whether that's in a, you know, a couple of years or 6 years or so years.
Yeah, sure. I mean, well, I think the concerning thing to all Republicans and conservatives should be that it seems to be the posture of the modern Democratic Party that every Republican president is now somehow fundamentally illegitimate. I mean, it's kind of started with Nixon, and I don't think it's changed much since. And Trump has brought it to really a crescendo. So the question is, what do you do when you have at least the leading edge of the other party, not the rank and file, not even the electorate, really does not think Republicans ever deserve to win or wield power? That's an interesting question. And we should think creatively about what to do about that, how to talk about it. I think we should try to de-escalate the sense in which we feel like we're in a cold civil war, but while at the same time recognizing that the leading vanguard of the other side thinks that we should never rule again.
Mm-hmm.
So keeping all that in mind, I hope a second Trump term, which I think is more likely than not at this point, I hope they've done a lot of executive orders on the bureaucratic administrative state. I'd like to see them pursue some real legislation on it.
Mm-hmm.
They really still have a crisis at the border, which I don't think they'll be able to do too much about, absent some subsequent electoral victories. So that thing that he ran on, perhaps more than any other thing, still remains really unresolved and really just bad as a matter of policy, as a matter of humanitarian crisis that needs to be dealt with. So that's what I would hope from a second Trump president. And then, you know, on the trade, landing the plane on the game of chicken we're playing with China would be excellent, especially if we landed in our favor, which I think has been Trump's goal. So, but post-Trump is a great question. I don't see too much evidence amongst national Republicans, that is, in the Capitol, with a few exceptions, of someone being a proper successor. I would hope a successor would take the lessons of that Trump illuminated about how to run as a populist and a populist constitutionalist, if I might coin that, running as a partisan of the middle class in a way, take those lessons, build upon that electoral coalition, and use that power and that momentum to restore the rule of law. I mean, a certain sanity, limited government sanity, and use it as a vehicle to remind people of what self-government in America should look like. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be small government. Small government will never be small in America again, but it can be limited. So some responsible superintendents of the things that the national government ought to do, put America first in foreign policy, put the large middle class first in trade policy, and restore some semblance of real borders that will protect the people in this country first and foremost, and then talk about who we should add to this,
okay,
to this populace. So that's what I would hope for.
Ryan, that's really fascinating. I loved every aspect of that, and we could have gone off in any of those directions for much longer. But sadly, we're out of time. But I just want to say a huge thanks and congratulations on everything you're doing at Claremont. And it's great for you to be able to join us today. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. This is great.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.